All right, welcome back. This is ACLS Part 2. We're not going to do an intro because we're going to just jump right into it. We covered an ACLS Part 1. If you haven't watched that, what are you doing?
What am I doing? What do you mean, what am I doing?
I'm saying, if you haven't watched that, what are you doing, audience?
Oh, yeah.
Like, honestly.
You just picked Part 2 from the beginning? Idiots.
Well, and you don't want a whole look at ACLS. You only want to solve bradycardia, tachycardia, strokes, and heart attacks. What if they die?
Just knock it off.
Stop it.
Okay.
So anyway, ACLS Part 2, we covered in ACLS Part 1.
Now that everybody's not listening anymore. Just
kidding. We covered in ACLS Part 1, we covered ROSC and we covered cardiac arrest.
Correct.
That's it, right? Yes.
Yeah.
And so now we're going to be covering tachycardia, bradycardia, acute coronary syndromes, and strokes. The other four topics in ACLS.
Mm-hmm.
With a quick review, we will talk about EKG reading one more time real quick, and then we'll jump into stability identification. Because that is an important part of kind of understanding ACLS. Because what happens is a lot of times these algorithms sort of split depending on if the patient is considered to be stable or unstable. So we'll chat on that.
And defining stability and instability is very, very important.
And we have a whole podcast on that.
We do. But in ACLS specifically, there are certain measurements and metrics and things that we look at to define whether someone's stable or unstable.
Yes.
And there's always, though, because obviously if you think about it, stability and instability is somewhat subjective and not always just completely objective. There's objective parameters and then inevitably always one piece that's like, use your judgment. You know what I mean? So anyway.
Okay, cool. So let's jump back into it. Reminder on the EKG here. We look at basically five things when we're reading an EKG. The first thing we look at is the rate, and the way to calculate that rate is to count the QRSs. This is going to be important because you're going to need to know if the rate is fast or slow to identify tachycardia or bradycardia, right? Mm-hmm. So first we look at the rate. Then we're going to look at the overall rhythm to see if it's regular or if it's irregular. So basically, are those QRS points, so are those R waves lining up appropriately? Is the same distance in between two R waves? If there's not, then we know that the heart might be skipping a beat. Maybe it's beating too early or too late, and it's not beating in rhythm, in a solid rhythm.
Maybe it's not coming from the right. Maybe the electrical stimulation is not coming from the right place, right? Maybe it's not the SA node. It must be somewhere else and that type of thing.
Maybe it's multiple places at once, like a PAC, a PJC. Mm-hmm. Then we look at P waves to see if the sinus is responsible for the SA node or the atria of the heart is responsible for beating that. Because if we see a positive P wave, we know that that is an atrial rhythm. If we see a negative P wave, we know that's a junctional rhythm. If we don't see a P wave, then it's either junctional or ventricular. Mm-hmm. And this is review. Then we're going to look at the QRS waves to see if they're wide or narrow. A wide QRS wave would be indicative of either a ventricular rhythm or something like a bundle branch block or something that's causing the stimulus in the ventricles to take more time depolarizing. And then lastly, we look at the ST segment. And basically, we'll get to this with ACS, but this is identification of STEMIs or end STEMIs. The ST segment can show us if we see elevation there, elevation of the J point, we will see that it gives us some evidence towards there's potentially a more serious heart attack happening. And we can talk about why that's more serious and physiologically what's the difference between an STEMI and a STEMI. And we'll get there. So those are the five things: rate, rhythm, P waves, QRS, and then ST segment. If you read every EKG that way, from now until the end of time, you will be able to identify 99.9% of all rhythms and weird things that can happen in your heart. So,
and as an ER physician, there's actually like a sixth step, right? So I look at the rate, I look at the rhythm, I look at P waves, QRS waves, ST segment, and then I call cardiology. And at that point, I cover my butt.
I will say, Chris and I spent some time in the ER together when I was in... when I was in school and he was in the beginning of his residency, and then when he was towards the end of his residency and I was transporting to him, we spent a lot of time in the ER together because I would transport over to him. But I remember like plenty of times I'd like ask EKG questions and stuff just about some like nuanced stuff. And I remember one time you being like, dude, let me just show you something. And you brought a stack of EKGs.
Yep.
And I swear to you, by normal standards, every single one of these was a STEMI.
Right.
There was ST elevation in terms of like there was ST elevation, and we also knew that there was symptomatology that told us that there was chest pain and stuff like that. So it's a STEMI, textbook STEMI. And you were like, these are all the ones that cardiology sent back to us and said aren't actually STEMIs.
Yeah, right.
So, and we'll talk about this in a little bit when we talk about ACS, but it's important to remember that STEMI is like a criteria of basically like flagging something for us to look deeper at. Just because someone has ST elevation on the monitor doesn't necessarily mean that they're definitely having a heart attack, and physiologically that all adds up. It just increases our...
It's another tool. It's another tool in your toolbox, right? So I feel like a lot of times, and I even felt this way coming up in, as a medical student, as a resident, even probably as an attending for a while, like that EKGs were something that you could read and completely diagnose from. And they're really not. They're one other tool that you can use to increase your suspicion or decrease your suspicion for certain conditions. But it's one piece, right? You cannot take a piece of paper with scribbles on it and like diagnose, treat a patient, right? It is a part of it. Just like you can't take one blood pressure reading or one heart rate or, you know what I mean, like one blood sugar measurement and treat a whole patient, right? It is one thing you have to look at. And there is some art and science to it. And the art part of it is that sometimes, even though it looks a certain way, you look at the whole thing and you look at cardiology and five people think five different things and you go with the best. You know, the best one you think is. Yeah.
The only real definitive way that we know that someone's having a STEMI or a heart attack in general is being able to like look in there and see it.
Right.
So it's similar to, you know, if you had, we know that when someone's having a PE, a lot of times their SpO2 saturation drops. That doesn't mean every patient that has a low SpO2 saturation is having a PE, right? So just another piece of data to help increase our suspicion for certain conditions.
Right. And when it comes to STEMIs, and you know, we'll talk about it with acute coronary syndromes, the purpose of the EKG is to help us figure out if we're going to go look or not, right? I mean, if we're going to actually do that cardiac cath and go look, because that in and of itself is an invasive procedure. So, like, we don't want to do that necessarily on everybody. So how do we know who we should do it on? And, like, again, one of the tools you have in your toolbox.
You want to just talk about ACS first?
You know what? Let's do that.
Let's just do that. We've already kind of built it out. So
I like it.
So yeah, and then the other thing that I want to add to that is, because I saw this all the time in the field, I see it all the time in the hospital, like, do not let the end result affect how you've learned to identify this stuff.
100%.
Right? Because what happened all the time is the medics that worked with me would basically, if they saw a STEMI, they saw ST elevation on the monitor, and the patient fit the criteria, they had chest pain, they, you know, maybe even they had a history for cardiac issues, and they called a STEMI code. So they called and said, this is a, you know, code STEMI, this is a STEMI alert. Any time that ended up not being confirmed by a they go in to put a stent in and they confirm that it's not actually a STEMI, that would disappoint the medics I worked with so much, and they'd be so discouraged about it. And it was sort of like you're
I was wrong.
Yeah, you're darned if you do, you're darned if you don't, right? But like, that shit shouldn't happen.
No, you weren't wrong. So this is the thing, is that there is a difference between interpreting an EKG correctly and what that outcome becomes, right? So if you look at an EKG and it meets criteria for STEMI and you call a STEMI and a cardiologist down the line says, no, I disagree, or they go to cath lab and there's no blockage there, you weren't wrong about that EKG, right? It's like looking at a heart rate and saying that's tachycardic. And then later someone saying like, oh no, this patient doesn't need any treatment for that tachycardia, that's their baseline. You're not wrong that it was tachycardia. There are criteria for that, right? So, and that's something in medicine in general we have to be super careful about, is that letting the outlier outcomes change how we practice the basics of medicine, right? And I used to see this all the time. And there was a case specifically where one of my attendings when I was in residency, I got an EKG. I'm trying to remember exactly the case, but it was something where like the EKG showed some like tachycardia and the patient didn't meet criteria for like a PE, mm-hmm. but the attending was like, oh, but one time I had a patient who was tachycardic and they did have a PE. So now I scan every single person who's tachycardic. Yeah, like you can't do that.
So that's
that.
The other thing is the reverse is true too, because then you'll have some medics that won't call a STEMI ever because they're worried about calling a STEMI and being quote unquote wrong about the end result, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have some other medics that always call a STEMI because they figure, oh, I'll just catch it. You know what I mean? Why not?
Even if it doesn't meet criteria.
STEMI, right? Yeah, yeah. And you can't do that either, right? Because that harms the system. But what's really important here to fix these communication issues is to, if you work in the ER or you work in cardiology, you work in the hospital and you're interacting with the people that are responsible for, you know, calling the initial STEMI alert, even if it doesn't turn into a STEMI, you need to kind of give those people an attaboy of, hey, no, you did the right thing. You definitely, yes, they fit the criteria for it. It didn't end up being a thing, but this is why that criteria is in place. Mm-hmm. And if you don't feel that way, then the criteria needs to change.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And that's on
yeah.
you. You know what I mean? That's on the hospital and on the yeah. research system and what we're using to flag. But never discourage someone from using the, you know, identification tools that you've instructed them to use
right.
to identify something, right?
Exactly.
So anyway, that's my spiel about identifying STEMIs. So just don't ever be afraid. If you think that it's a STEMI, call it and give that report, mm-hmm. right? And here's the thing too, is you're sending the EKG to the hospital anyway, right? So they're going to get a look at it as well. So what you're not technically, when you call a STEMI alert saying this person is having an ST elevated myocardial infarction, you're saying this person meets the criteria because I see ST elevation. So if you just say in your report, I see ST elevation in 2-3 and AVF, that's all you got to do, right? They can confirm that.
For me as an ER doctor too. I don't cath people. Right? So when a patient comes in and you show me that there's a STEMI and I look and I say, there's a STEMI and I activate the cath lab and I do all the things, if the cardiologist doesn't want to take that person to cath lab, well, that's on them. It doesn't change the fact that I need to activate that system because, you know what I mean? So, right. And unfortunately, we do see that a lot.
Yeah.
And if you look at ACLS guidelines, and I don't believe this has changed anytime soon, but if you look at ACLS guidelines, technically, any person who meets criteria should be cathed every single time. Now, the system doesn't work that way
right.
because cardiologists get bad outcomes if they cath people who die on the table. There's a lot of like politics and also like just kind of like nuances there. But if you look at the actual guidelines, really like everybody should be cath if they meet criteria.
Well, because the cath is not just the procedure of like stenting someone, it's the visualization of the issue too. So right. the catheter is used to go in and look in the first place. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So let's break it down to basics a little bit and go real basic with what acute coronary syndromes are. So acute coronary syndromes, coronary is referring to the coronary arteries, the vessels that supply your heart with blood. When we have an acute coronary syndrome, we basically have a lack of blood supply to the heart muscle itself, right? And this can be caused by a couple things. It can be caused by a narrowing of the vessels.
Constriction.
Yeah. So
not constriction. A blockage necessarily, just constriction yeah. of it.
That constriction can be from spasm. That constriction can be from, you know, I have too much plaque buildup. The plaque doesn't even have to rupture. It just, it swells, right? It can be from inflammation. It can be from, I guess Prinz metals would be like a spasming. So, so the couple ways that it can constrict, right? It can be from a blockage completely, where maybe a piece of plaque breaks off and then blocks it. Maybe
becomes which is an embolism, right? A piece of plaque, it's a foreign entity like breaking off, traveling to an area and causing a blockage.
Right.
Or it can be thrombotic, where it's just that plaque gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it just blocks that area, right? It doesn't break off and travel somewhere. It's just right there, but it gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, it can be a result from our clotting cascade in general, so it can be our attempt to stop a bleed. The clot becomes too big and basically scabs over and blocks that vessel. And then you can also get acute coronary syndromes from things like bradycardia, right? If my heart is beating too slow, I'm not getting enough oxygen to my heart to continue to beat. So there's lots of ways that you can have lack of oxygen to the heart.
So yeah, so there's a couple different acute coronary syndromes, right? So there's And we define them based on what the mechanism is for that lack of oxygen to heart tissue, right? There is unstable angina. Well, there's angina.
So you, in recent years, have been saying angina, all right?
And I don't always, like saying angina.
Is it just because you don't like saying it? Because it can be pronounced either way, correct?
I think it can be pronounced either way. I don't like angina. Saying angina.
I like angina.
I wasn't trying to be
funny there, and I realize I'm hilarious all the time, but I do like that pronunciation better. Angina to me sounds weird.
Okay. Well, you can have how do you want to say it on the podcast? Then we got to pick one way to say it. We're just going to confuse.
I think we say angina.
All right, fine. I don't like it though. So also, anyway, you can
here's the thing, if I take a clip from this and I say angina and I take a clip from that and I put it on TikTok, maybe TikTok reads that word wrong and then the views of that video goes up higher
because people are searching things that are like angina.
Mm. I honestly think that. So there's a TikTok that we had that has over 500,000 views. And I think it's just because I said the word nipple in the video because I was talking about the nipple line.
Yeah, probably.
So I'm just saying.
Just keep saying.
Play to our strengths. Yep. Angina.
All right. So anyway, so acute coronary syndromes, you have angina, you have unstable angina, you have STEMIs, and you have NSTEMIs. So ST elevation myocardial infarctions and non-ST elevation myocardial infarctions, which are really one thing. It's myocardial infarction.
Yeah.
But again, there's like technically three, right? Or is there more than that? Those are the three that we typically define within acute coronary syndromes.
I mean, you named four. Unstable, stable.
Well, I'm saying it's angina, stable. Unstable angina, and myocardial infarction.
Yeah, essentially when we're talking about ACS, we're talking about chest pain protocol.
Yeah.
Just chest pain protocol in general, right? So,
but angina is basically lack of oxygen to the heart tissue that can cause symptoms, but it doesn't cause irreversible damage.
Correct.
It doesn't, no tissue dies.
Right.
Unstable angina is where that's happening, like even at rest. Which is, so like angina is where, you know, maybe you exert yourself, you snort some cocaine, I don't know, whatever you're into, and you get chest pain symptoms. You get symptoms of lack of oxygen to the heart tissue, mm-hmm. but there's no reversible damage, or there's no irreversible damage, excuse me. Unstable angina is where you're getting those types of symptoms even at rest, which is a problem, right? Because it means that there's enough of a constriction or enough of a potential blockage that like we could be heading towards a more serious event if that's left untreated,
yeah.
right? You can stop snorting cocaine. You can't really like make your plaque smaller. You actually can.
But
that's a whole different story.
So unstable angina though, like at rest, stable when I'm running or I'm exercising or something like that, it's still a precursor to, there's a lack of health here that we need to adjust.
There's still acute coronary syndromes.
It's obviously more serious if at rest when my heart rate is as slow as it can be and I'm as calm as possible, I don't have any adrenaline running through my system, I'm still hurting, right? And
exactly.
It's not going away.
Right. So. And then myocardial infarction, and the key word there is infarct, infarcted tissue, dead tissue. So there's been enough of lack of oxygen to the heart tissue to cause death of tissue, right?
So it's the difference between ischemia and infarction, right? Ischemia is just the lack of oxygen. That's going to happen. And every myocardial infarction will start with mm-hmm. angina, right? Yep. So first you'll have the ischemia, and you may or may not be symptomatic with it. Symptoms will start to develop as you have that lack of oxygen extend for a long period of time. And then eventually that heart tissue will start to die or infarct. And it'll die in a bullseye-like pattern based on where the blood is supplying, mm-hmm. right? So right in the area that where the blood hits the most is what's going to start, you know, dying first.
Right. So the other thing too is, and this is a generalization, but that's what we like to do here is back to basics, kind of generalization so that we can wrap our minds around this stuff. Stable angina, right? To your point, I start running a marathon or I start just running across the street and all of a sudden I start having chest pain. We typically treat that with symptomatic treatment and lifestyle changes, right? You clearly got plaque buildup, or we do some tests to see if you have plaque buildup, right? And we say, okay, so we're going to change your diet. We're going to put you on antihypertensives, antiplatelet drugs, aspirin, things like that, right? To try to make that better. When we get to unstable angina, that's where like these are symptoms are happening at rest. I'm getting chest pain when I'm sitting watching TV. Those patients typically need a cath at some point. They may not need an emergent catheterization, but they probably need a catheterization and some type of stent. Because like we're not going to probably reverse that soon enough with the lifestyle changes and medications that we could.
And a stent or a cath is opening that vessel up. So mechanically going in and putting in like a mechanical mesh mm-hmm. to reopen up that vessel yeah. and expand it so that we can get better blood flow.
Yep, exactly. And then myocardial infarction obviously needs a stent or a cath. Right? Those need to be opened up more emergently because that tissue's dying and will continue to die if left untreated. Super interesting, actually, and I don't think this is talked about enough, so I'm going to like sure. give a little side note here. There have actually been studies, and I think these studies were done like in the 90s, but like there have been studies of people who had cardiac cath confirmed plaque buildup in their vessels who went on plant-based diets and then got recathed after, I don't remember exactly how long, but got recathed after like a year or something like that and no longer had plaques.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy.
Like
reverse plaque buildup. We don't talk about that enough. That's crazy. I didn't know that until I was like an attending physician. Mm-hmm. I thought like once you had plaque, like you kind of had that plaque and you just tried not to get more.
Yeah.
You can actually reverse it, which is crazy.
You can unclog your arteries essentially, right. Which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Which is crazy. So, but who wants to?
Yeah. I mean, not worth it.
No.
Cats aren't that expensive. Just kidding. So that kind of describes the two conditions. We're dealing with ischemia or we're dealing with infarct. The thing is in the field, if you're EMS or if you're noticing this on the nursing floor or anything like that, it's still going to be like a rapid call or a high priority patient. Like we have protocols on my nursing floor that if you have someone who has chest pain that doesn't go away with rest, that's like you're going to call for a rapid response. So you're going to have the RRT team come and examine that patient because it could be something very serious. There is no way symptoms-wise to determine whether or not someone is having an infarct or if they're just having the ischemia and the angina, right? So what we have to do is we have to treat all these patients the same in terms of our emergent immediate treatment. Mm-hmm. And that is where the MONA protocol comes in.
Are we still using MONA across the board?
Yeah, sometimes it's FONA. Sometimes it's basically you're going to be using analgesic with oxygen, nitro, and aspirin.
All right, so for the sake of this, let's talk about MONA, right? So MONA, M-O-N-A, you've got morphine, oxygen, nitroglycerin, and aspirin. And each of these is doing something a little bit different.
And they're not done in that order, which is weird. We just try to make it sound cool, like MONA. Like I guess that sounds more like a name.
Mona Lisa, probably.
I guess. I don't know. You know, Mona Lisa could have been, you know, I'm not even going to get into it. I read the Da Vinci Code series recently, probably none of it's facts.
No,
but no, a lot of people think that Mona Lisa might have been a self-portrait of Da Vinci in drag.
Oh, that's cool.
Isn't that weird?
Yes.
Is it cool?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I don't know really how I feel about that. Yeah. I want someone to have caught Da Vinci doing a self-portrait in drag, who like walked in and be like, what are you doing, bro? You know? Anyway.
Something to think about.
We digress. So MONA, morphine, oxygen, nitro, aspirin. We don't do them in that order.
We start with oxygen, right? Oxygen. We have lack of oxygen in the tissue. What do? We're going to give them oxygen.
Exactly.
Pretty simple. And we're going to titrate. Chris and I always say titrate to 99% because that way you'll know if they decompensate faster.
Correct.
Right? That's all we're going to say on it. You can look up our other videos to figure that one out.
Aspirin.
Aspirin is an antiplatelet. It is not a blood thinner.
Correct.
It prevents the platelets from being sticky, which means it's an antiplatelet. And therefore loosens up.
It just prevents further plaque building.
Further clotting. So it's not a clot busting medication. That's mm-hmm. called fibrinolytics, right? Mm-hmm. If we gave fibrinolytics or thrombolytics, then we would be busting a clot that's existing. The aspirin is just to make sure that now that the heart is under extra stress, that we're making the platelets a little less sticky so we don't propagate the current clot. If it's a partial clot in a vessel, and mm-hmm. we're not going to have any more clots while the other vessels are under stress, right? Nitro. Nitroglycerin is a medication that expands coronary vessels. And we talked about this recently. There's a TikTok that went out that was kind of big about mm-hmm. nitroglycerin because I compared it to Viagra or Cialis. And there is truth to that. Absolutely. Viagra and Cialis were both attempts to make a version.
That's
of
how
nitro.
We found nitroglycerin for chest pain, is that people were trying to use medications to treat erectile dysfunction. And it was a side effect.
I thought it was opposite. I thought it was that people were trying to improve cardiac output, and then basically they're like, yeah, but I've had an erection for 8 hours. What do I do about
either way, great find.
Win-win.
Yeah,
you know?
Right?
Yeah, we talk about this, and when we talk about cardiac medications, just sort of different medications can target, they have the same mechanism of action, but they can target different areas, right? So nitro, Viagra, and Cialis all have very similar mechanisms of action where they expand vessels, but nitro specifically works on the coronary arteries very well. So nitro expands that vessel, and that makes sense. We want to open that vessel up because it's closed or it's narrowed or it's spasming. If we can open that up, we'll increase the amount of fluid or blood getting to the heart and therefore the amount of oxygen getting to the heart. If we expand that vessel, though, we need to also understand that relatively we're dropping blood pressure, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of nuance and argument into, okay, well, if someone is hypotensive or if they have the potential to be hypotensive, depending on where blockage is in the heart, if I give nitro, could I technically bottom out their pressure by opening the vessels and reducing the amount of fluid because there's not enough fluid in the system, okay? So that is a consideration you need to make. Your protocols will dictate whether you use nitro in all STEMI cases, in all angina cases, or if there are certain, for instance, like a right-sided MI, if you'll hold off on that. My recommendation is always just call for orders. If you have a right-sided MI, that's the one that has the potential of bottoming the pressure out, just call your ER doc, your local ER doc, and say, hey, I've got a right-sided MI. I'm suspecting a right-sided MI. Would you like me to withhold nitro? That's the safest way to do it.
Yeah. I also feel like, and this is, again, follow your protocols, both in hospital and on the road, depending on what kind of provider you are, but there is also like an argument that like nitroglycerin, if you're bradycardic, might not be a great idea either. Mm. You already have a low heart rate. And then if you did like lower the blood pressure, now you have like even more. I mean, again, follow your protocols for it. But
yeah. So oxygen, aspirin, nitro, and then we would move on to an analgesic. So in the MONA protocol, we're referring to morphine. Sometimes you may use fentanyl, you may use other pain medication. The reason why morphine was for the longest time preferred is that morphine actually has some coronary vasodilation effects as well, just like nitro does. So it helps open up the vessels as well as take care of the pain. Now, why is taking care of the pain in acute coronary syndrome, besides just being nice, why is that important in terms of reversing an infarct or right. preventing an infarct?
So the idea is that what are the things that are going to increase strain on the heart, right? Increasing your heart rate, increasing your blood pressure. These things are going to actually like potentially make things worse if you've got a blockage there. So what analgesics do is also is that they calm you down, right? So they almost like de-stress you a little bit. They take away the pain. So the pain is not a stressor anymore. Your body's more relaxed. So you don't have spikes in heart rate. You don't have spikes in.
Hey! Oh my gosh. See what that did there is Chris's heart rate is skyrocketing now because he's scared.
Wow.
Into kind of like a.
Jeez, man.
Some.
Thank God I don't have plaque buildup.
Right? Like, so he's scared. His heart rate's up, right? Which is why calming a patient down, giving analgesics that will calm them and take away the pain is going to help.
I would like the fentanyl now. No, I want fentanyl now.
It's going to be okay.
No, I want fentanyl. No,
this is important for our audience to realize that calming a patient and being kind to a patient and compassionate care goes a long way in truly saving lives because it lowers that workload on the heart.
That's a great demonstration.
Thank you.
That was really scary.
Sorry you're the back above it. And I'm sorry, Jamie, who's going to have to edit the sound so it doesn't like blow out the speakers. So, okay, that is ACS, right? So that's how we're going to treat acute coronary syndromes in the meantime. We're going to run a 12-lead EKG, and we're going to see if we can identify ST elevation. If we see ST elevation, then we're going to go ahead and let them know the hospital know, hey, they're having a STEMI as well. So this meets STEMI criteria. The difference between an NSTEMI and a STEMI, so non-ST elevation versus ST elevation, is on the monitor, there's ST elevation or there's not. In the body, what's happening is a complete blockage of a vessel will result in ST elevation. So that patient needs a cath because there's complete blockage in the vessel. If I have partial blockage in the vessel, that's an NSTEMI. That patient can survive with blood thinners and thrombolytics, things to dissolve the clot, right? Now, some hospitals have cath labs and some don't. All hospitals have thrombolytics. Mm-hmm. So it might change your destination depending on if they have ST elevation as well, mm-hmm. right? So if I look at the hospital, I'm the same distance between a hospital that has a cath lab and a hospital that doesn't have a cath lab, go to the cath lab hospital. That makes sense, right? If one's farther away, I need to see if Chris is having ST elevation. He's having ST elevation. Well, I'm going to actually bypass the, per protocol, bypass the hospital that just has the thrombolytics to go to the cath lab for an emergent cath.
So this is going to raise questions like, well, wait, why don't we do and we're going to talk about stroke next. If we do thrombolytics for stroke, why don't we do them for myocardial infarction? The reality is that I don't have a good answer for you because there's a lot of like conflicting literature as to like some literature has shown that like by giving thrombolytics in a myocardial infarction, you could increase the risk of like disrupting the fibrin clot and causing more thrombus or bleeding. But now there's actually research coming out saying that like, well, maybe we should reconsider that. Like one of the contraindications historically for not giving thrombolytics in stroke was a recent heart attack because they're worried about like,
but we do give thrombolytics in stroke, so long as it's
we do a stroke. We do a stroke, but why not? We don't always for myocardial infarction, gotcha. And like why? And what I'm basically trying to paint the picture of is that like there is research on both ends to say maybe we should be, maybe we shouldn't be, So that's why we haven't figured it out yet. I guess is my answer. And someone's gonna say like, yeah, we have. We absolutely should do it. Cool. I don't know. I've seen the research on both. If you look up the guidelines. There's still contraindications if you've had a recent MI to not give thrombolytics and stroke when we're reconsidering that in some of the literature and stuff like that. So yeah. Just worth noting.
Cool. Yeah, bottom line, though, is that we do the ST elevation not to change our treatment. We're still going to do MONA protocol in the field. We do the identification of the 12-lead with the ST elevation to determine what destination we should go to because they may fit criteria for cardiac catheterization. All right, that's ACS. We're 25% of the way done. We've been talking for way too long. Let's do stroke real quick because this is really easy right after that.
Stroke's pretty easy.
What's the difference between a stroke and a heart attack? Just the organ.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much just the organ, right? Right. We're dealing with the same thing, ischemia and or infarct in the brain. Now, ischemia in the brain will result in stroke-like symptoms, so neurological symptoms. but
they go away.
That's what, yeah, they're going to go away after a time because we can restore blood flow to that.
Just
that's
like your chest pain does in angina.
Exactly. Angina and mini strokes or...
Yeah, you got to be careful what terminology you use, but yeah.
Yeah, angina and mini strokes are semi-synonymous in the sense that we're...
And mini strokes is also like a term that like people don't like to use, so...
But it's a transient ischemic attack is what we
TIA,
call
TIA, right?
A TIA. So a TIA is what... If your grandma says I had a mini stroke, she probably had a TIA. So a TIA just means that there was temporary loss of blood flow to an area that showed ischemia, but didn't result in infarct.
And if your grandma says I had a mini stroke, but she can't move the left side of her face, no, she didn't. She had her full stroke.
Exactly.
So, but right. I mean, like, honestly, like, yeah.
And what's so scary is, so I had a very good friend of mine recently had a stroke.
That's right.
Young guy. Had a stroke. And it was because of not a defect, but basically like a congenital like shrinking of a vessel that feeds his brain.
It's crazy.
So it wasn't necessarily blockage and stuff like that. So when he went hypertensive, it gave him a stroke because of the extra pressure on that thinner vessel. But I remember just kind of like, we talk about this stuff all the time. He's a paramedic as well. But you're sitting in the hospital and it's like, did I have a TIA or did I have a stroke? And we're like, we don't know yet. We have to wait to see if it goes away.
Yeah,
like,
right. If your symptoms don't go away.
We haven't been able to get imaging yet or anything like that. And like, he didn't meet the criteria for some stuff. So it was like, we got to wait. And and that waiting can be pretty spooky. Yeah. Right. So, but yeah, TIAs versus a full stroke or a CVA, a cerebral vascular accident, is when a CVA is when we have true infarct of tissue. And that is irreversible brain damage, death of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Depending on what vessel, just like in a heart attack, depending on what vessel, we might see different things on the 12-lead EKG. Depending on what vessel, we'll see different things on a CT scan. And it's going to affect symptoms. So there are some areas that will do more weakness on one side of the body. There are other areas that will do vision or speech changes. And if you want a detailed view of all of those, you can check out our videos that are coming out very soon, sponsored by Medtronic. I don't remember what their name they're called. They're really long names.
But
the stroke Medtronic
alert
ones. Yep, check those out.
Yep. So what's interesting with stroke is that it's there is certain criteria for treatments of stroke, right? So there's one, you have to identify them, right? So and again, watch the stroke videos that we did because we really get into like what tools you use to, you know, quote unquote, diagnose one, and then what tools you use to put them on a scale to know if you should, you know, how big they are, how severe they are, severity scales. We won't go over that here, but basically what we do is the most important thing is to identify when was the onset of symptoms, right? If you went to bed fine and you woke up not fine, well, the onset of symptoms is somewhere in between there, right? So the last known well is what we use. The last known well time would have been when you went to bed. If I'm sitting here talking to you and all of a sudden I develop symptoms, you look at your time, that's my last known well was just a minute ago before I started having symptoms. And that's important because there's two things we look at in stroke. There are hemorrhagic strokes and there are ischemic strokes. Hemorrhagic strokes is hemorrhage, bleeding in the brain. Ischemic strokes is lack of oxygen, just like a myocardial infarction.
From a blockage or clotting or narrowing of the vessel.
Yeah, something like that, right? If it's a hemorrhagic stroke, we're not giving fibrinolytics, right?
Well, we need, you know, because blood thinners, right? We're not going to give blood thinners or clot busters to someone who's actively bleeding out because if you cut yourself shaving and I give you a bunch of blood thinners, what's going to happen to that bleed?
Right.
It's going to propagate, right? So the same thing happens in the brain. So our first and foremost priority right now, as protocol stands, is to get the patient, if we identify stroke symptoms and we've ruled out stroke mimics, is to get the patient to a facility that has a CT scanner. Mm. We don't care how high up on the chain of stroke care hospitals that is. Get them to a CT scanner, any facility with a CT scanner. If we can get them there, because we need to confirm whether it's hemorrhagic or ischemic, and then we can consider things like thrombolytics, or there's actually kind of a version of a catheterization for stroke now for larger blockages in the brain called thrombectomies, where they can go in and they can pull the thrombus out, which is really cool. So becoming more and more alike, heart attacks and strokes are, you know, even in our treatment of them, they're becoming more and more alike. Right. But we're not going to do the Mona protocol with a stroke patient because we're not trying to expand vessels in the heart, so the nitro and the morphine are pointless, right? Mm. There's no pain, so analgesics aren't going to help. We'll give them oxygen, sure, but we're not going to give them aspirin because aspirin's an antiplatelet, and if they're having a hemorrhagic, that might propagate the bleed.
And this is where the question around fibrinolytics in myocardial infarction comes into play. So even in strokes, we get a CT scan, we see that it's not a hemorrhagic stroke. We know then it must be ischemic. Only if they're in a certain few hours window can we give fibrinolytics? Because if they're beyond that time, we worry about irreversible damage. And when tissue dies, it becomes friable and like fragile and can easily bleed. So that's why, like in strokes, unless it's in that time, typically we won't give fibrinolytics or clot busting drugs if they're outside of that window. With myocardial infarct, unlike the brain, when you have lack of oxygen in your brain, you know it immediately. You develop symptoms. The heart's not really like that. So that's where it's really hard. Like as a doctor, I can't be like, oh, is this the first time you've ever had any symptoms of heart? Like you just threw a clot to your, no, oh, I probably had chest pain before. I know I have, you know, I know I have some plaque buildup. So like that's where like we just don't know a lot of times in terms of like that window. Stroke's easier because lack of oxygen to the brain, you see it right away symptomatically. Lack of oxygen to the heart, you develop symptoms, but it's really hard to say like, are these brand new symptoms? Or are they not? So that kind of goes back to the question of like why we definitely do fibrinolytics and clot busting drugs in strokes within a window and why with myocardial infarction, we're still not sure if and when we should be using them.
All right, so that covers ACS and strokes. Let's jump into our tachycardias and our bradycardias. Before we get into this, let's just briefly state how standardly ACLS would define instability, because in these protocols, we're going to have a kind of a different algorithm for tachycardia that's unstable and tachycardia that's stable, bradycardia that's stable and bradycardia that's unstable. So how do we define stability?
So the way we define stability when it comes to ACLS, right, whether a patient's stable or not stable, is we look at their vital signs and we look at their symptoms. I mean, it's simple as that, right? So vital signs are going to be blood pressure, SpO2, heart rate, and then again, and then we go to symptoms.
Yeah, blood sugar, I guess you could say.
Yeah, blood sugar you put in there. Symptoms, there's specific symptoms we're looking at, right? We're looking at symptoms for some of the things we already talked about. Do they have altered mental status or do they have signs of ischemia, in like heart ischemia type of thing, right? Because really stroke and ACS are the things that we're like we're most concerned about.
Yeah, because
or anything.
An unstable patient is someone who has lack of perfusion to a major organ, right? And the major organs are the brain and the, I almost said spinal cord, I'm very tired. The brain and the heart in this case. So if you have chest pain, you're automatically unstable.
Right.
If you have altered mental status, you're automatically unstable. It's not normal to be not fully conscious and alert, right? Symptom-wise, the symptom that we tend to look at the most is blood pressure because it relates to systemic perfusion. Mm-hmm. So if you have a low blood pressure, you are considered in a lot of these algorithms to be an unstable patient.
We define low blood pressure as anything below 90 systolic.
Correct.
Per ACLS guidelines. Again, like there can be arguments for other people being unstable at different parameters. We're not talking about that. We're talking about ACLS guidelines right now.
And there's outliers all the time, right? If you're a ultra marathon runner, maybe you sit at a lower blood pressure all the time. And that's, but we don't build algorithms based off of outliers. We build them out of the general population. If you have a systolic blood pressure of less than 90, you are considered unstable for these algorithms.
We do not build, I like what you said there, we do not build algorithms based on outliers.
Right.
We build them on a cohort of white 20-year-old men, which is actually, I'm making jokes, but it's actually true. If you look at how we, back in the day, defined blood heart rate between 60 and 100, is they actually just took a bunch of white dudes who were like 20s to 30s and took their average heart rates. Probably not the best way to figure out what the average is for
also,
like.
So that's funny that you mentioned that is in scuba diving to figure out the dive tables for how long you're supposed to like decompress for and stuff. They used like young military men. And it's like, what a terrible, like, you know how many like not the body type of a young military man are scuba diving right now? And we're based off of their like decompression.
And that's why you see so many 60, 70 year old men who are out of shape who scuba dive having
trouble
issues.
With decompression. Yeah, it's true. But yeah, so just something to consider. Like we do have to make some generalizations when it comes to defining stability. Otherwise it's not a definition, right? We have to set it somewhere, right? So tachycardia is considered anything above 100 beats per minute. That's another thing, right? You might be tachycardic right now because you drank some caffeine, but you are tachycardic if you're above 100 beats per minute. There's got to be a cutoff there. You're bradycardic if you're below 60 beats per minute. Mm-hmm. So 59 is bradycardic, 101 is tachycardic.
Right.
60 to 100 is what we would call normal cardiac or just a normal heart rate.
And then so the question becomes, is that tachycardia or bradycardia unstable? And that's where we look at the blood pressure. I argue that we should look at the SpO2 as well, and we look at symptoms, right?
And you can look at the situation, right?
Yeah.
If I just got done running and I'm sitting there with a heart rate of 160, That's not normal heart rate for someone my age or me normally, but you know that I was just running. So, right. So you're not going to panic about a heart rate of 160, right? You have to take all these things into consideration.
And it's where reassessment becomes a key piece too, right? You don't just take one measurement and then base everything off of that, right? You're continuing to check vital signs and things as you move forward. So in the ACLS algorithm, to keep it simple, bring it back to basics, we're talking about tachycardia and bradycardia, the algorithms, right? Tachycardia, bradycardia. We had to decide, is it stable or unstable? And the way we do that is by looking at their blood pressure.
So let's start with stable, okay? So if I am bradycardic, we'll start with slow heart rates. If I'm bradycardic and I'm stable, so I don't have symptomatic bradycardia. I'm not symptomatic
pain,
right now.
No chest pain.
I'm stable and I'm bradycardic.
Do nothing.
Well, right. Do nothing. First of all, like, how'd you end up in this situation in the first place where you even know? You right. know what I mean? But yeah, there's no danger in being bradycardic. If you're,
you might want to investigate it.
Symptomatic.
You right. want to look into it.
Right. Well, so like I'm a long distance runner and I will average a resting heart rate in the 40s.
Yeah.
That in someone who's 80 years old and isn't a runner, that's a concerning bradycardia. And if they don't have symptoms, maybe you need to look harder to see if they have symptoms. Right.
Yeah.
Everything in consideration. That's where you bring in that provider judgment, right? But if someone is stable and bradycardic, what you want to do is you might still want to bring them in for evaluation or have them follow up with their primary care physician, but there's nothing emergent right now to stabilize, right? They're already stable. We don't need to stabilize. ACLS is about stabilization.
Right.
It's not about long-term treatment. It's about stabilization, right? So we're not really going to do anything with bradycardia that's stable. With bradycardia that's unstable, so I'm symptomatic now. Maybe I feel woozy or I'm dizzy or I have an altered mental status or I have chest pain or, you know, anything like that, right? We're going to speed up their heart,
right?
Right. So there are two ways that we can speed up their heart. We can do it pharmacologically and we can do it with electricity, mm-hmm. right? So we can use our monitors to put AED-like pads on the patient and pace the patient, where we basically electrically stimulate the heart at a rate that we choose, and we typically choose 60 beats per minute. To get the heart to beat at 60 beats per minute, it's going to shock the heart. Every time it shocks the heart beats, and they're going to be jumping up and down kind of a little bit. Their chest is going to be jumping up and down, and we're going to speed their heart rate up by introducing electricity to it, right?
Correct.
And that is what we would call transcutaneous pacing, or TCP. So transcutaneous pacing should be done on any unstable bradycardic patient. What we can also do, and we should also do, is give them a medication that can speed up their heart as well.
Right.
And the medication that we typically choose in ACLS protocol is called atropine. A approved dosage of atropine is going to work as a chronotropic to speed the heart rate up.
Right.
So we're going to give them that medication. Now, there's not a big concern about all of a sudden making someone tachycardic with these types of treatments, especially if you're doing transcutaneous pacing. Because if I'm pacing someone, their heart rate can't go faster than what I'm pacing them at. So there's no concern. Like there was a case that we reviewed on another podcast that we talked about. Like there's not really any concern with transcutaneous pacing. They're not all of a sudden going to be paced at 120 or going tachycardic. While when you're using pharmacological means to speed someone's heart rate up, we can't cap what that heart rate is.
Right.
You know? So that's where the Edison before medicine is what we say a lot of times in terms of priority of treatment for unstable patients. Using electrical treatments tend to be a more effective and safer way to treat the patient.
Now, the problem you may run into with bradycardia and trying to use transcutaneous pacing is that if the patient's very awake and alert, it can be uncomfortable, right? You're literally shocking them through their skin to get their heart rate going. So maybe you need to give them some sedation or something to relax them. Well, you got to be careful there too, right? Because you don't want to like have that relax them so much that their heart rate goes down because they're already bradycardic. Right. So yes, you can try a dose of atropine or two. It's pretty quick most of the time to put an IV in, give a dose of atropine, see if it works while you're hooking things up. But if you have a patient who continues to be bradycardic, despite your pharmacological treatments, you have to go to transcutaneous pacing you have to do something to bring that heart rate up.
Well, and that's a big argument in EMS right now is that I think EMS providers get a little bit confused about, okay, they're unstable bradycardic. I'll start them with atropine and then I'll move on to transcutaneous if I get really worried. And it's like, no, they're unstable. If they're unstable, hook up the pacer. Right. You're not going to harm somebody with the pacer. You can make them uncomfortable, but you're not going to harm them. Right. And if you get that capture first, and then you go ahead and follow up with some sedation or some pain meds or something like that, there's no danger of that heart rate dropping because you have good capture, right? So Nothing wrong with that. You've made a lot of arguments in the past for if you plan on inserting a pacer to someone in the hospital, if you're going to put a pacemaker in.
So in the emergency department, if I come in, if someone comes in and they are bradycardic and they are unstable, there have historically been arguments to put in a transvenous pacer. And that's essentially where I go into the internal jugular vein, run a catheter down into the atria, try to capture electroactivity with that node, and then pace the heart literally like inside, right? But what I've seen done so many times as I've come up in medical school and residency and as an attending is that residents or attending physicians, emergency physicians will work on floating a transvenous pacer and not have started transcutaneous pacing. And my argument is that if you think the patient is in such dire straits that they need transvenous pacing, that you need to go drape them, sterile technique, put a big catheter into their internal jugular vein, go down, then you should be transcutaneously pacing them, right?
In the meantime,
And then the question is, if you can transcutaneously pace them and get capture, they probably should just go to the cath lab to get a permanent pace, not the, you know what I mean? So yeah. like, there are arguments back and forth on that, but I'm just saying like, think about what you're doing and why you're doing it. If I truly think a patient needs a transvenous pacer in the ER, the way I do it now, if I truly feel that's the case, then I have to transcutaneously pace them first.
It's very similar to saying this patient needs to be intubated, but I'm not going to bag them until it's time to intubate them.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Like, it doesn't make any sense. Exactly. Like, you have to have that kind of transitional treatment.
100%.
If it's important. So that's bradycardia. Essentially, that's it. I'm mixing it up. Yeah. So
there's
other chronotropics that you can give as a second consideration. So you can, if those treatments aren't working, you can move on to more of like a catecholamine drip to speed up the heart. You could do like an epi or a dopamine and use its chronotropic effects to speed up. So you could do like basically a catecholamine drip where we're doing a drip rate of epinephrine to speed the heart up and do it that way. Those are a little bit more long term if we're talking EMS. But typically, transcutaneous pacing, if you can get capture, that's going to do it for you, and you're going to be good to go. So
you can consider push dose too. I mean, like they're like it, that's not an ACLS guideline, so
what we're shifting to a lot right now.
Yeah. So you push dose epi. It's not currently in ACLS guidelines, but you can do push dose epinephrine to just keep the heart rate up while you're trying to get atropine working, while you're trying to get transcutaneous pacing working, while you're trying to transport so they can go to cath lab for a pacer, things like that.
And then tachycardia. So if we are stable but tachycardic, there's a couple things that we can do to try to non-invasively slow the heart rate down. And the first thing that we would consider
We didn't mention, though? We need to go back to bradycardia, vagal maneuvers.
No, that's tachycardia. I'm about to say it.
Perfect.
I did the same thing, though, because the way I have it listed on here is...
Okay, perfect.
So a non-invasive way that we can slow the heart rate down is vagal maneuvers. Vagal maneuvers are essentially activating the vagus nerve, so activating the parasympathetic nervous system in your body through natural means. So one way that your body activates its parasympathetic nervous system is when you're pooping. So if you bear down, you flex the muscles that you would when you poop, that will actually lower your heart rate and kind of slow down your metabolism. It'll work on the parasympathetic. Mm-hmm. So we can ask people to do that. Hey, I need you to bear down. And you might need to explain what bearing down is because some people don't know. It's also important to tell them not to actually poop.
True.
I've had that happen where I'm like, you need to kind of like flex like you're going to poop, and then the patients just poop themselves.
Right. But you know what? A small price to pay in order to get your heart rate down.
This was a large price. So anyway,
another thing you can do, so I've seen this where you like have them like blow into like a straw, but like that's capped.
Yes.
Right, so that's like blowing against something that like they can't, you know, like that was the same thing, right? So it's a version of bearing down, but it's something maybe easier for them to understand.
Yeah.
Blowing into that closed.
They've actually been doing this technique in ERs lately where they have someone blow through a straw and then they swoop their legs at the same time and they like give them
make
that
them
like
fall.
They like, yeah, make them have the feeling of falling. So they like do this whole weird thing and then that's supposed to be like really effective. But it's always been funny to me because it's like, how did they come about discovering that? Like, how many weird things did they do first? You know? But there's a couple other ways to activate. Cold compresses on the back of the neck and things like that work great.
And if you think about it, like when you jump into a cold pool and you're like, you know, like that kind of like, that's right. That's that vagus nerve being like stimulated. So like with children or babies too, like you can't tell them how to bear down. So you take like a cold bag of saline or like ice and like put it on their face and just kind of get them to like
that shock,
get that kind of that shock feeling. Yeah.
Yep. Something that you may have heard of before that we no longer do is a carotid massage. So we do not do carotid massages anymore, because what would happen is when we massage that area, though it can activate the vagus nerve, it also can like grind up plaques that we have in there, and like potentially those plaques could then break off and go up into the brain and give us strokes and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we stay away from carotid
massage.
That'd
be the worst.
That would be
the worst.
Yes.
You're like symptomatically bradycardic and then stroke out.
Don't do carotid massage. We don't do it anymore. Cool. So that's your non-invasive means. Then you would move on to if they're still, you know, if they're symptomatic but they're stable. You know, it kind of all depends on what you're dealing with. But if you want to move on to further treatments, you can consider pharmacological intervention.
And I'll say for unstable tachycardia, like the blood pressure's off, they're symptomatic, like, yes, you can still try vagal maneuvers while you're getting the other things ready, right? You shouldn't forego pharmacological treatments in unstable tachycardia to do vagal maneuvers. But as you can see, like, it's pretty simple to do vagal maneuvers. You can do that quickly while someone's establishing IV access. You know what I mean? So
the next thing that we would move on to with stable or unstable is we can consider pharmacological measures, which would be adenosine. Now, remember, with unstable treatment, we do have that kind of rhyme, Edison before medicine, where we're always going to consider the more effective treatment of electrical intervention. And the electrical intervention is cardioversion, which we'll talk about in a second. But I just want to talk about the pharmacological that can happen, you know, as a non-responsive to vagal maneuvers, so we want to move on to adenosine, or we're already cardioverting and we also want to add pharmacological interventions to it, I guess is what I'm getting at. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Because people get confused. They think like, oh, pharmacological is for stable. Well, if you're stable tachycardic, you don't always have to like...
You don't always have to bring the heart maneuvers,
and then you can just, you can just consider, like, you can just monitor them and keep them comfortable, right, and have an expert review and take them to the hospital. Right.
And if I have somebody who comes in who's tachycardic at 200 beats per minute and they're stable and it's like AFib, I'm not giving them adenosine. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to other medications that are approved for that condition. You know what I mean? So, like,
I would argue that if you're 200 beats per minute,
well, you're probably unstable.
Probably in VTAC, there's no way you're stable. Right.
So is it worth talking about identifying the complex first?
Yeah, so you do – I don't know if it is, because the algorithm doesn't really change.
Sure.
Tachycardia is tachycardia, and we're really concentrating more on stability. There are some medications that are better for wide complex tachycardias than adenosine, which is what we're talking about now, would be. And if you have like an irregular rhythm, you typically want to stay away from adenosine. Adenosine works on the junction of the heart. So essentially, it's going to stop. It's going to slow down the impulse right at the AV node. So if you're generating a heart rate below the AV node, like a ventricular rhythm, adenosine won't work on it anyway. Right.
So there is, if you look at the ACLS algorithm, there's technically like two tachycardic. There's narrow complex tachycardia and there's wide complex tachycardia. And I think as we're trying to bring it back to basics, we're talking about addressing the unstable patient in general with pharmacology and electrical. But if you have a narrow complex tachycardia, we sometimes define that as like an SVT. That's where we would try adenosine, because adenosine works at the junction, and we know that if it's narrow, it's coming from above the junction. But if we have a wide complex tachycardia, adenosine's not going to do anything. So we can skip adenosine and go right to the electrical.
And that's where like AFib with RVR and things like that, some of these irregular rhythms, that's why it's so important. The second thing we do is we look for regularity, because we need to figure out, is our heart rate just fast? Or is our heart rate fast and irregular? Because if it's fast and irregular, then we want to consider medications like antidysrhythmics. So that would be like things like amiodarone, lidocaine, things like that, which we talked about a little bit in the cardiac arrest treatment stuff. So amiodarone is kind of your go-to for, right now at least, for irregular heart rates when traditional treatments aren't fixing it. But just talking about adenosine, yes, this is mostly for supraventricular tachycardias, so tachycardias that are generated above the AV node or at the AV node. And what it does is it slows down the heart. So it captures that impulse and holds that impulse there, doesn't let it go into the ventricles for a little bit, and slows down that heart rate.
It works on the AV node. Adenosine works directly on the AV node. So that's why it's only effective in supraventricular tachycardias.
Yes. In terms of giving adenosine, it needs to be given very quickly. So we typically will follow this. We'll do this IV push, rapid IV push, and we'll follow with a flush. And we'll usually pinch off the line as we push it so that there's nothing in between. It's just that full bolus of medication. It has a half-life of like 6 seconds or something like that.
But you have to let your patient know they're going to feel like garbage for like a couple seconds.
If I force your heart to all of a sudden stop for a second and really slow down, you'll actually see these patients sometimes flatline for a period of time on the monitor, just a couple seconds. But they're going to feel that too, and their body's going to start going, oh, something's wrong.
Like,
right?
It's like an impending doom type of thing. Like, why is you've stopped your heart for a second?
So let them know they're going to feel kind of lousy and make sure you push it rapidly. Moving on to electrical, cardioversion is what we'll do for tachycardias. If they're unstable and they're tachycardic, I recommend cardioversion right off the bat. You can do this at the same time as adenosine. You can do it before adenosine if you want.
If it's SVT and it's unstable, like their blood pressure's low, they're symptomatic, their altimeter status, cardiovert them, right? Yes, you can try adenosine as you're getting ready for cardioversion if you'd like. Wide complex tachycardias, ignore adenosine. If they're unstable, you go right to cardioversion. Yeah.
So cardioversion is basically it is not a defibrillation. It's a synchronized shock to the heart. Mm-hmm. And what we have to do is we have to program the monitor to basically mark the R waves so that we're shocking at a very specific time. So you'll see little arrows pop above the R wave when you sync a wave, and then you go ahead and give synchronized cardioversion where you shock the heart. If we don't synchronize, it's essentially shooting without aiming. And if we do that, there's a potential that we can shock them during the refractory period of their heart's electrical activity, which is the time that the heart is resetting to be able to depolarize again. And if we shock someone during that time, we can potentially put them into very dangerous rhythms. So it is very important that you just do one
thing. As in like asystole.
Yeah. Or right. VFib. Right. Right. So you can make them pulseless. You can kill them by shocking them on the wrong spot. All you got to do is remember to hit the sync button. Just hit that sync button and you're good to go. And then we usually shock in stackable dosages. So we start at a manufacturer recommended dose, and then sometimes that goes higher and higher. You always shocked at kind of a standard dose. You usually stayed pretty high when you were in the ER.
So, I did this for a reason. So I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if the ACLS algorithm itself calls for a range of, what is it?
It depends on the monitor, actually, but like 100, then 200, then like if it's a standard shocking stackable dose would be like 100, 200, and then
400,
300, and then max. You can't shock at 400. A lot of them max out at like 360.
Okay. But I think if you look at the ACLS guidelines, it says like you can start at 100, and if that doesn't work, go to 200.
Yeah.
I just always did 200.
Yeah.
I usually got to sedate someone for this anyway, right? I mean, you're not going to, you can't like cardiovert somebody who's awake. I mean, you can, and if you have to, you need to.
Yeah.
I always try to sedate them, give them something, right? You know, a lot of times, even you give them something, they wake up, they're like, holy, you know what I mean? Like, you're shocking them hard. But like, if there's a chance I'm going to have to do it a second time at a higher dose, it was just easier just to do it at 200 to begin with.
And you have that prerogative because you can practice medicine.
Yeah, don't.
EMS providers and nurses on our RT teams that are following protocols.
Start at 100.
You got to do the manufacturer recommendations, and it's probably going to be stackable doses unless a doctor orders.
There's actually arguments now and research that shows that you can like double stack them. So like literally like hook up two different monitors and shock them at the same time with both.
What?
Yeah. I don't know. Weird stuff.
Interesting. But that is how you would cardiovert someone. So Chris mentioned the sedation thing. You may not have sedation protocols. Pain meds are fine. It's a one-time shock though. So a pain med's not going
to
be really helpful.
If a patient is unstable, it is more important to try to make them stable than it is to make them comfortable, unfortunately. You know what I mean? Like, for them. But, like, honestly,
anytime that I have cardioverted, there has been no sedation. Because if I'm cardioverting, I'm in the back of an ambulance, and I feel like the patient's severely...
Well, and if they're truly unstable, like, they're probably altered anyway a little bit. Like, I mean, like, hopefully they don't remember. Or if they do, they're alive to remember, so...
All right. So that covers brief review of EKG interpretation, stability identification, ACS, stroke, tachycardia, and bradycardia, and that brings us to the end of our review of ACLS.
So I will say the one thing, too, for these tachycardia and bradycardia algorithms, if at any time the patient becomes pulseless, you change over to the cardiac arrest algorithms.
Yeah, so that's worth mentioning, right? These aren't like, hey, he's having chest pain, so he's in this box of ACS protocol, right? Like, you can be tachycardic, and because you're unstable tachycardic, it's causing chest pain. So it is up to you as the provider to kind of figure out what algorithm you're going to be at what time, right? And there can be a lot of, okay, is he having a heart attack and that's thrown off his electrical rhythm now, so he's bradycardic because of that? What is the underlying cause? And that's only going to happen through good assessment, history taking, understanding your situation, and knowing your stuff. It's not going to happen from a deep study of the algorithms.
Right. You also can operate in two algorithms at the same time.
Correct.
and I'll just make a note of this, and I won't reference anything, but if you have a patient who is bradycardic and having severe chest pain, and you think that they may be having myocardial infarction, you can treat their bradycardia and should treat their bradycardia because they are unstable. They're having chest pain. That is unstable bradycardia, as well as give them aspirin and nitro. You can do that and should.
I would also say something that I would see all the time when teaching ACLS is it's a very common ACLS test, like one of the scenarios where you have a patient that is in ROSC. So they were in cardiac arrest, and then we return to spontaneous circulation, and their heart rate's real slow. And the first thing that people do is like, okay, their heart rate's low, I got to get that up. I'll go ahead and give atropine.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wait. I would consider this patient to be pretty unstable since they were dead 30 seconds ago, right? We can, and there's already pads on them because we've been shocking them.
Right.
Pace them. Just pace them in ROSC, right?
For sure.
Get their heart rate up by pacing. It makes way more sense.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Also, like that med's not going to circulate very well if...
You just got ROSC.
They were dead.
Yeah.
Something to think about.
Cool.
That is going to end our episodes on ACLS. If you want a CE credit for this, go check out guardianCME.com. And we'll see you next time. Stay sweet.
Hey guys, thanks so much for taking a listen. If you are studying for the National Registry exam, we're here to help. We have a National Registry prep program to help you pass that exam. Check us out at guardiantestprep.com. If you'd like continuing education credits for listening to our podcast or watching this on YouTube, follow us at guardiancme.com. 100% free CAPC credits. No matter what state or country you're in, we're here to help. So again, we thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful week.